Welcome to the Wasatch Hills Church Podcast, a ministry of the Wasatch Hills Seventh-day Adventist Church with Pastor Bernie Anderson. Our prayer is that what you hear will inspire, equip, and perhaps introduce you to a new walk with Jesus Christ.
Well, as you've probably guessed, our topic this morning has a little bit to do with trust. And I must say that as I was looking at what I wanted to share this morning, what the Lord was laying on my heart to share, that I really wasn't sure exactly what the title should be. And it kind of came in that, since Pastor Bernie wanted it a couple weeks ago, I said, okay, it's Who Do You Trust? But I sometimes think the title really should have been Who Do You Really Trust? Because a lot of times we mouth the words. You know, we see the words on our coins. Most people in this country, if you ask them, do you trust in God? They would say, oh, yes, it's on our coins. That's our national motto. But when we look at our actions, that's where it really tells the whole story. And, of course, the other thought that I also had for what we're going to be sharing today was, one sin, one solution. You know, wouldn't it be a lot easier if we only had to deal with one sin instead of all the different ones? And if there was only one solution that we had to worry about? And then, early this morning, I woke up and it was, oh, no. It should have been the devil's favorite temptation. Because literally, his favorite temptation is that we can do it on our own. And he knows that it's one that works, because that was the one that caused him to fall. And so, what I want to share with you is actually, it's going to be a little different than what I had envisioned earlier as I was working on this, but I want to share with you what has transpired. Last week I had the opportunity, for those of you who are here, to share a little bit of my testimony of the things God has done and kind of interrupted my life and changed things. But I want to share with you a little bit of the thought process and some understandings that have become more clear to me over the last several months. To start with, it actually started back last fall. I've been very involved in financial markets, working with people, training people, personal empowerment, financial training, that type of thing for the last probably just about 20 years now or more. And so when the stock market started melting down, when major companies that we had seen last forever began to fold, at the same time that it's a presidential election, I began to wonder what is really going on. And this was where part of my journey back to God actually began, was kind of looking and saying, I remember, and Pastor Bernie's been talking about the good news of the second coming, but I also remember what I used to think of was the bad news of the second coming. Does anybody know what the bad news of the second coming is? It's this little thing that happens right before the second coming called the time of trouble. And I was going, wow. Are these the things that are leading up to that? And what happens? And it led me to actually go grab a book off the shelf, one of the few that I had retained, which was a book called Great Controversy. And I read a statement in there. Actually, I read the whole chapter, several chapters, and was kind of wondering, what is really going on here? What is happening? And there was a quote in there that really caused me to think. And it was talking in relationship to the time of trouble. And it says, those who exercise but little faith now, and faith is actually, we'll talk about it a little more, but faith is also trust, is probably the better translation of the word, are in the greatest danger of falling under the power of the satanic delusions and the decree to compel the conscience. And even if they endure, and this is what I found fascinating, is it says, even if they endure the test, they will be plunged into deeper distress and anguish in the time of trouble because they have never made it a habit to trust God. Well, I didn't really like what I was reading, because it was basically saying, yes, if you haven't developed trust now, you can, God will work with you, he'll help you make it through, but it's going to be a tougher time. The lessons of faith which they have neglected, they will be forced to learn under terrible pressure of discouragement. We should now acquaint ourselves with God by proving his promises now. And I read that, and it caused a series of thoughts to start running through my mind. And it led me to ask this question, you know, how do we actually prepare? I mean, I've grown up in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. My dad retired working for the church. My grandma was baptized when she was a teenage girl back in Arkansas. And we've always talked about getting ready for the second coming. In fact, I gave a sermon a number of years ago called it's Bernie's topic, paracesis, paraklesis. It's that Greek word. I didn't do well in Greek. But it was paraklesis paranoia. And the whole thrust of it was that we often get real worked up about the second coming. We kind of get scared. We start doing things we maybe shouldn't do. And yet the reality is it could happen for any one of us at any point in time. So I've never been one who spent a lot of time worrying about the corporate second coming, saying, you know, you need to get ready for that. But I've always believed we should be ready at any point in time because we don't know when we're going to take and get in front of a Mack truck that doesn't see us. And it could be our second coming, whether is for everyone else or not. So that's one thought that has always run through my mind. But I started asking myself, well, how do we really get ready? And if it was this thing about trust, if about being ready, it led me to begin a study of what it means to really trust God. And this is, and these are some of the thoughts that I began to find and began to discover. First of all, as I mentioned, I am not what you would call a Greek scholar. Elder Richardson can actually attest to that. He was our Greek teacher back at Southwestern Adventist College when I was there. And he was absolutely amazed that I graduated. In fact, he was amazed that I got the grades that I got in Greek based on how little I studied. And now as I look back, I wished I'd taken more advantage of it. But one of the things that we find is if we go into the Greek in the Bible, the word that is translated faith, it's the same Greek word that is sometimes used as trust, the same word that is sometimes used as believe. And so over the years, I have had a habit, even years ago, and I had written it in, and we sometimes forget things, but throughout my Desire of Ages book, wherever it talked about faith, I had out in the margin F equals T. And I've made the habit of a lot of places actually crossing out the word faith and writing in the word trust. And literally, if you do that with any text, it actually gives you a richer meaning of what the word faith often, than what faith, I mean, sometimes the word belief actually connotate. Because we use faith and belief in so many different situations, in so many different instances. And yet trust has to do with really relying on someone. In fact, numerous times in the Spirit of Prophecy, it says that faith is trusting God. And so I started looking and saying, okay, well, if faith is trusting God is something that that we need to do, and this is something we need to learn how to have, how important is trust in the eyes of God? Well, if we look at Romans 14:23, it gives what I believe is probably the best definition of sin in the Bible, much better than the text that we often quote where we say sin is transgression of the law. But this actually gives the definition of what sin itself is. It says, whatsoever is not of faith is sin. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute. Whatsoever is not based on trusting God is sin. Well, that was a big aha for me because it was like all of a sudden, wait a minute. We can prepare a sermon and that's sin. We can do good things for other people and it's still sin. We can do all kinds of things and it's still sin. It actually takes sin to a much broader, deeper meaning in our lives and helps us see how really sinful we are. You know, it's easy at times, depending on what happens in the day, depending on how other drivers drive, to actually make it through a day where you kind of look back and go, hey, you know, I didn't do so bad today. I mean, I remember as a kid, growing up with my sister, we used to have a habit in the evening that was part of our evening ritual. Usually it was you know, right as we were going to bed, because we wanted to make sure that we were able to sleep safely, we'd call out to each other, "Hey, Annie, I'll forgive you if you'll forgive me." Of course, we always qualified it. But we kind of had that fear because we knew, and we didn't really want to take and have to ask for forgiveness for all the things we'd done to each other all day, because, you know, that could have taken quite a bit of the evening. But, you know, and we had no question that we had done something, because we could usually irritate one another in some way to provoke, and, you know, better than even a, you know, a tailgating driver. And so when we begin to look at that, this is where the concept comes that there is really only one sin. You know, God says sin is when you're not leaning on me, when you're not relying on me, when you're not counting on me totally. And that's what sin is, and that is what results in these things that we call sins. In fact, if you look at the text that says sin is transgression of the law, probably the better translation of that is sin, which is not trusting God, results in transgression of the law. And so I began to realize as I looked at this that, wow, it's all about who am I trusting. You know, am I trusting God or am I trusting myself? Am I trusting someone else? Another thing that is another interesting text is Hebrews 11:6. And this really shows how God feels about it when we don't trust him. It says, "But without trust, faith, it is impossible to please him." Impossible to please God if we're not trusting him. And then in Jeremiah 17:5, it says, "Thus saith the Lord, cursed be the man that trusteth in man." Well, as I read this, I began to realize that God had a little bit of an issue with trust. In fact, I began to think, you know, God is kind of hung up on trust. What is going on with God that he is this concerned about us trusting him? That this is literally the foundation of everything that's going on. Well, if you go back and you start doing some study of what happened in heaven before our earth was even created, if you start reading what happened with Lucifer, you know, Lucifer didn't wake up one morning and become the father of lies. He wasn't a liar. Lucifer was an intelligent being. He was the you know, one of the most beautiful beings, one of the most respected beings. I mean, he was next in rank, right next to Christ. Other than being part of the Godhead, he was chief of all the angels. And yet, what did Lucifer do? What happened on that Tuesday morning when Lucifer woke up from having slept the wrong way? He started, first of all, he didn't really actually start distrusting God, but he started to question. He started to go, you know, I wonder if this way God does it is really right. I wonder if we couldn't have more freedom if we did something different. And those thoughts started going through his mind, and slowly he began to distrust God. I mean, that's literally what happened. You know, we don't see that, oh, Lucifer broke the fourth commandment. You know, Lucifer didn't keep the seventh commandment. Well, literally all those different things started happening as he began to distrust God more. In fact, you know, one of the most heinous sins, plural, things to God is pride. Well, why would pride be one of the most heinous sins to God? It goes back to the same thing, because we aren't proud unless we're trusting in ourselves. If I'm trusting God, I can't get proud about trusting God. If I'm doing something on my own, I can be patting myself on the back. And so Lucifer's pride then stepped up, and that's where he got to the point where it was like, hey, no, I'm in full-out rebellion. I'm going to do it on my own. I'm going to show the universe that that we can do it without having to do it God's way. And that's what led him into all the other sins, and the thing that led him to the point where he would even have Christ crucified. Now, Jeremiah 17:7 also says, "Blessed is the man that trusteth in the Lord and whose hope is the Lord." And then Solomon was a little more blunt. You know, sometimes I like Solomon, sometimes I don't like Solomon. Sometimes as I read his writings, I think he was depressed and kind of upset with the whole world, and he was just taking and putting down his thoughts. But he's real clear in Proverbs 28:26, "He who trusts in himself is a fool." Well, this is what we call one of those aha moments, the Ford light bulb moments. I was looking, saying, okay, hey, you know, issue is with Lucifer was about trusting God, but he's wanting to trust himself instead of trusting someone else. It really drove home the concept that sin is living a life apart from God, which is trusting anyone or anything other than God, including myself, and this is what results in sins. See, one of the things in the culture I grew up in the environment I grew up in, I was taught that we had to be working, the fight of faith was about really getting good at stopping sinning. Have any of you gotten good at that? Have any of you ever noticed it's a saying in the personal development realm that whatever we resist persists? And in fact, the more I push against something, what happens? It pushes back. It gets worse. In fact, I remember a song that we learned at camp meeting. It kind of gives me chill bumps now to think of the words of it because it was so blatantly wrong. But it was called, "I Am Determined. I've Made Up My Mind. I'll Sin No More." And that was the extent of the words. You sang them about 18 gazillion times. And I was, you know, I had to learn to play the piano about that time, so I was being forced to practice. So I learned to play that on the piano. Well, in my desire to not sin, to be able to live the life that God wanted me to live, I thought, well, maybe if I remind myself that I'm determined I'll sin no more, maybe I won't sin anymore. And so when I get upset with my sister, my mom could tell when she had done something that irritated me, because I would head for the piano. And I would sit there and I would start playing, "I Am Determined, I've Made Up My Mind." And the more upset I was, the louder I played. You know, I mean, it was like, maybe if we really get after it, we won't do it. And yet the good news is that not what sin is about? God has something so much better for us. You know, when we try and do it on our own, we just get discouraged. And I know that is a part that had to play into my kind of wanting to get away from all of it. I still remember as a kid walking down the street, though, and it was kind of like, people would ask that question, you know, if you were hit by a car, would you be ready for Jesus to come? You know, and I'd be walking down the street, and it was kind of like, well, you know, I don't think I want, you know, do I, you know, I was just mad at so-and-so. I better go get it forgiven, if I got hit on the way home, I wouldn't make it to heaven. So when we're trying to live our life based on behavior, rather than based on whether we're trusting God or not, we're fighting a battle we can't win. In fact, what we're doing is very much, if you were to come over to our home for dinner, and as you're sitting there in the living room, and, you know, we're busy in the kitchen fixing dinner, and all of a sudden you start noticing that the smoke alarm is going off. For some reason, I have overlooked the skillet is on the stove with it turned up higher than I thought, with a lot of good olive oil in it. And all of a sudden, there's flames and smoke coming from the kitchen. And you see me run in, grab the fire extinguisher, and instead of running into the kitchen, I run into the living room where you are, and I start spraying the couch. You'd probably get a little worried about me. You'd be going, "Hey, you're fighting the fire where the fire isn't. Why don't you go to the kitchen?" And that's what so many of us have been doing, is we've been fighting the fight where the fire isn't. We've been fighting the individual sins, the individual actions. We've been thinking, hey, if I keep the Sabbath, if I do this, if I do this, if I do this, then I'm okay with God. In fact, it's a little bit about the words. I like the words and I don't like the words of the song, "Trust and Obey," because it's almost like they're two distinct things. If you trust, and then if you obey. So, okay, yeah, I trust God. I already saw it on my coin, so now I've got to work on the obeying. But the reality is that when we trust God, we automatically obey. He does it for us. In fact, the big issue with God is a trust issue. I mean, he's seen what happens when we don't trust. He saw what happened to his good friend Lucifer. I mean, think about it. God has to be torn up about Lucifer. I mean, it wasn't just an angel that he saw now and then. This was the angel that worked with him all the time, the one that he cared about, the one that he'd put his most special gifts to, had blessed the most. And he's torn up about Adam and Eve. What commandment did Adam and Eve break? You know, I don't remember the 11th commandment. Thou shalt not eat of mangoes. See, anybody knows it was not an apple. It had to be a mango because that's why it was called mango. Because then God had to come and say, man, go. But it wasn't about that. It was about they were distrusting God. God said, you can have all of this over here, but leave this one alone. Don't even go near this one. Basically, he was just having to see, are they going to trust me? Or are they going to take and decide to do it on their own and listen to what Satan says when Satan there in the tree says, hey, you know, God's wrong. If you eat this fruit, you're going to know more than God. I mean, you're going to be like God. And so, you know, that's why God has this big issue with trust. The other thing is he also knows us. One of the key things about trust, and we'll be getting to it here in just a moment, but to trust someone, we've got to have someone who is trustworthy. Absolutely essential. And I don't remember the text, but text goes along the line of basically Jesus didn't trust someone because he knew they were a man. He knew they were human. And he knew what humans do. They're not trustworthy. I mean, God doesn't even want to trust us to obey him. God says, hey, you know, if I have to trust you to obey my law, to obey the things that I would like you to do that I know are for your best good, I know that we're both in trouble. So if you'll just learn to trust me, I'll actually come in and do the obedience for you. I'll come do it through you. I'll come do it in you. And what I realized, and once again, back to this progression of thoughts and seeing how it applied to my life, is I realized that, as I asked myself, I said, well, I've always had a trusting God. Or I've always been under the delusion that I was trusting God. Why are things not working the way they should be? What I discovered is that I was trusting God in the realm of salvation. I was not so ludicrous as to say, you know, I think I can save myself. I'll just do my own crucifixion, or I'll do my own sacrifice, or I'll do whatever. I can make it to heaven on my own. But what I was ludicrous enough to think is that God wanted me to trust him over here in the realm of spiritual things, in the realm of salvation, in the realm of what would happen in the next life. But I also was under the misimpression of a text that actually came from Poor Richard's Almanac, not from the Bible, unless it was Hezekiah. And that is the text that says, the Lord helps those who help themselves. You know, Poor Richard's Almanac, Benjamin Franklin. That is not a biblical principle. And then the other thing, you know, so I had this idea that, okay, God's over here. You know, I'll trust him with that. But when it comes time to take care of the bills, well, Lord helps those who help themselves. I better get busy and go do. I better do this. I better do that. In fact, one of the first things when I first went into sales as a real estate agent, one of the first things that intrigued me was my first broker started teaching us how powerful we were. Now, does that sound interesting? He said, you know, you've got within you great powers. You can do anything you want. You can be anything you want to be. You can have anything you want. A lot of what we call the positive mental or self-help genre of what's out there today. And I really liked it. In fact, that's why I say this is probably the devil's favorite temptation. Because it's really appealing. Hey, you know, I can do that. I can take and build this. I can do that. I can do the other. I. And the whole challenge was I was not relying on God for those other aspects of my life. And a couple of places where I saw it exhibited in the Bible, first of all, you know, right after the flood, I mean, now God commended Noah for his trust in him, because Noah by faith went and built the ark. But Nimrod, did anybody hear of Nimrod? Is he in the chapter on faith? He's not in the chapter on faith, but what did he do? He went and built a tower. You know, a boat, a tower, you know, I mean, kind of just similar. But the difference was God had, you know, first of all, God had said, I'm never going to flood the earth again. So if Nimrod was going to do anything, he should have built a heat shield. You know, God says, I'll burn it up, but I'm not going to you know, destroy it with water. But, you know, he's wanting to do it on his own. You know, the people at the Tower of Babel were doing it on their own. They were going to save themselves on their own. The one that really hit me, though, is a guy by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, this was not what you call a Christian hero. In fact, he was the king that captured the Jews and took them to Babylon, took them over there to, you know, as captives. You know, we've got the different stories of him. But he made a statement. He looked over, I mean, and Babylon was a beautiful city. I mean, it had the Hanging Gardens, one of the seven wonders of the world. And King Nebuchadnezzar's walking out around the city, and he goes, "Wow, is this not the great Babylon that I have built?" Here, a heathen king is taking glory for the city that he has built. And God says, "Uh-uh. You think you're the one? You think you're the top dog here? You think you're the one that created all this? You think you're the one that built this and that I wasn't the one actually working in and through you to have these things happen?" And so he basically told him that he was going to get to be the first hippie. Now, the reason they know he's the first hippie is because for 7 years, he grew long hair, and he was out on grass. Actually, he was eating it with the cows instead of smoking it. But, you know, he had a 7-year learning curve. And at the end of that is where he said, "God is the one who sets up kingdoms. God is the one who does everything, not just over here on the spiritual side, but over here on the other side as well." And so that led to another aha. Now, the next thing was, as I looked at this idea of obedience, back to the trust and obey, this was one of the early discussions that we had a lot of when I was in academy. In fact, a lot of very heated discussions, because once again, the concept that we could become righteous by trusting God started resurfacing about the time I was in academy. You know, within our church history, it had become very prevalent towards the end of the 18th century, 1895, Wagner and Jones. And then we had a pastor there when I was in Mountain View Academy by the name of Morris Vinden. And he was just beginning to start teaching these radical things that if you trusted God, he'd take care of things. And so we had a lot of this discussion. But, you know, but wait a minute. How does that relate? How do the rules relate to the trust? How do those two things work together? And what I realized is that literally every command and every commandment that God has given us is nothing but an invitation to learn and to trust and rely on Him in another area or aspect of our life. See, this was one of the things that really threw me in February when I felt the conviction that I should be coming back to church. Not only coming back to church, but it was like, you've got to keep the Sabbath. It really is important to me. And it was like, but wait a minute, God. I don't have enough time to get everything done when I'm busy all day on Sabbath. How can we take off on Friday night all the way through Sabbath, not even take care of the yard? I mean, not take care of, you know, how can I have time? So I realized that the Sabbath was literally Him saying, I'm inviting you to learn that I can make sure you have enough time. Second thing was like, but wait a minute. Do you ever have that challenge where there's more bills than there's money? Or there's more month than what there's money comes in? And like, well, wait a minute, give tithe and offering? Oh, wow. He wants me to trust Him with my finances. He wants me to trust Him with my career. He wants me to trust Him with my relationships. He wants me to trust Him with everything. And literally, as you go through, and I would invite each of you, is don't take my word for it, begin to look at each of the commandments, at each of the things that God says that He wants us to do. And look at that and say, how is this giving me an opportunity to learn to trust God more? Now, I'm not saying go ahead and say, okay, I'm going to trust. That is not what He's talking about. But it's something for you to look at and say, how would I have to trust God? How would my faith in God have to grow for me to be able to do this? See, there were certain health issues. Now, I mean, I had quit smoking over a year ago. So I at least had that one where I wasn't worrying about it when I was coming back. But there were other things that I've been working on wanting to improve my health, and I realized that a lot of what happens in our lives, and this is why they say sanctification is the work of a lifetime. Has anyone ever peeled an onion? Have you ever got through peeling it where you finally got to the core? When you get to the core, there's nothing left if you actually took it one layer at a time. And our lives with God are a lot like peeling an onion. God shows us, you know, he says, okay, here's what I want you to do. This is a new way for you to trust me, something else that you're not trusting me in. And so as our relationship grows with him, we trust him. He works that out in our lives. And then he goes, oh, guess what? There's another layer. There's another level. And so he's constantly showing us more and more. I mean, with the idea of health, until we take and have our bodies totally in great shape, honoring him, and he gets us there, there's always something more, something that we can do that would bring more. So it's not a matter of, well, okay, do I eat this or not eat this? You know, where along the continuum do you draw the line? But it's a matter of trusting God that he's going to lead you as to where you need to go so that you can have, you know, are you willing to trust him with your health? Are you willing to trust him that he wants you to have a body that is vigorous, that can take and do the work that he has for us to do? And so what I realized is that all these things deal with trust, but again, back to how does this deal with probably one of my unfavorite texts, which was in James, where it says, faith without works is dead. And it was one that I had heard many times, not in pleasant conversations. It was like, no, you can't just rely on faith, because faith without works is dead. Well, let's change the word a minute. The word we put in is trust without works, or without something that exhibits that we're trusting, is not really trust. The story I like to share that illustrates that is the tightrope walker who was going to walk across Niagara Falls. You know, kind of scary, kind of exciting, one of those things kind of like the Eva Knievel days, where lots of people gathered to see, you know, is the guy going to end up, doing a flip-flop down the falls. And so they had the wire across, people on both sides. And he gets up and he walks across the tightrope, and he makes it to the other side of the falls. And he gets over there, and I mean, everybody's cheering. And he turns around and he walks back. And I mean, now they know he is really good at crossing those falls. And he says, okay, how many of you believe and trust that I can take and push this wheelbarrow across to the other side? And of course, everybody said, yeah, we do. You can do it. Sure, go for it. And he goes, but do you really trust that I can do it? And they all said, absolutely. No question. And he goes, great. Then which one of you wants to ride in the wheelbarrow? And the crowd got silent. You know, they were claiming that they trusted that he could do it, but they weren't willing to put their fannies where their mouths were. And that's in the wheelbarrow. And so I began to realize that that's basically what James was saying is, when you're not, when you're not producing the fruit, you need to take a look at your faith. Who are you really trusting if the fruit's not going? He's not saying, go out and get busy hanging fruit on the tree. You know, you don't take and turn an oak tree into an apple tree by tying apples on it. You know, it doesn't do anything. In fact, if you leave the apples there, they rot and fall off. You know, they don't even ripen or anything. And so that's not what he's saying. And so I started asking myself, okay, what do I have to do to start developing this trust? And it's back to the two things. And it actually took me back to my first days in sales training and the gazillion people that I've trained since then. One of the first things that we teach people in marketing and sales is that people will only do business with you if they know you, if they like you, and they trust you. And nobody's going to trust you if they don't like you, they probably won't hang around anyway. But until they know you, they're not going to really trust you. And so part of what we used to teach people is you have to become known. You have to let people know who you are. And so what we've got to do is we've got to get to know God. I mean, that is why getting to know God is probably the most important thing we can do, because I can go work on trust, but if I don't know God, I'm not going to have that full reliance on him. If I don't know him without question, I'm not going to have that reliance on him. And that is why, and we don't have time today to go into all the supporting scriptures on this, but that is why it, you know, God basically predicates our salvation not on what we do, not even on how much we trust, but on how, whether we know him or not. And the reason that he's willing to do that is because, and this is a thought that came to me last night coming down the canyon, and I just had to pull off to the side of the road and write it down. It was like, where'd this come from? It says, as important as it is to God that I trust him totally and keep his commandments, he is more concerned that I get to know him. Because he knows, not that I know, but he knows that if I get to know him, I will automatically trust him. Because he knows how trustworthy he is. And if I'm trusting him, he will be able to work in and through me to produce the fruits of faith, the fruits of trust, which is obedience. And so what I realize, it's a lot like looking at a tree. And often when we're looking at a tree or a plant or whatever, we don't see the roots. But literally, the roots are probably the most important part of the tree. At least with our large evergreen tree out in the yard, when we found out the roots had a problem, the whole tree was having a problem. And yet I didn't get up and spray paint it to get the needles back going green. We came and started working on the roots. The person who did our landscaping came over and gave a shot of some stuff down at the roots. The roots of our Christian life is knowing him. That blossoms up into the trunk of the tree, which is the tree of trust. Knowing him causes us to trust him. As we trust him, that's when the fruits of obedience come. So we don't worry about the fruit, we worry about what's happening down at the root. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to just share with you very quickly a prescription for getting to know God. And we could actually have a whole series of talks on this, but I just want to share this with you because this is the most important thing you can do. And if you don't take anything away from here today other than this, I would encourage you, this is where the Christian life is at. This is where the fight is at. This is where the fire is. The fire is in the kitchen. We've got to deal with the fire in the kitchen, and that is getting to know God. And the only way I can get to know God is by spending time with him. And the prescription is very simple. Spend time alone. See, we can come here, and coming to church is a lot of what is very similar to the analogy I would use with my coaching clients. I have a weekly session with my coaching clients where we give them some information, we give them some things to work on, and many of them are under the misimpression that what they're going to create in their business or their investing or whatever they're doing is going to be as a result of those weekly coaching sessions. If they're not available for the coaching session or things aren't moving forward, they're going, well, when are you going to give me the extra stuff? And one of the first things I tell them is it's really not about what happens in the coaching session. It's not really about what happens here at church. It's about what happens between sessions. It's about what you do between now and next Sabbath. And there's really only one thing we can do, and that is to spend time alone with God at the beginning of every day. Some real reasons for starting at the beginning is because, well, at the end of the day, it's kind of hard to say, okay, God, can you help me through yesterday? It's already over. And it is a struggle. You know, look how many times Jesus said, you know, watch and pray, and the disciples kept sleeping. It's a struggle sometimes to get up, but God will give us the time. He will give us the time to be with him. And we spend it in Bible study and prayer. Basically, three things. There's only three tangibles we can do, and that is spend time in his word. That's our eating. You know, none of us would take and say, well, I'm only going to eat on Sabbath. I'm going to eat once a week. We're going to have a big potluck at church, and that's going to do me for the week. Now, maybe it would help me if I would do that, but, you know, we've got to eat every day if we're going to have nourishment. We've got to exercise every day. You know, just thinking about exercise doesn't work. I've tested that already. Trust me. And this last thing is, you know, is breath, breathing in and out, and that's prayer. You know, we're not praying to God for things. Often we think of prayer as being about, well, bless this and bless this and bless this and do this and do this and do this. And now, thank you, God, I've given you my laundry list. We're off for the day. But it's actually about talking with God. Have you ever had a good argument with God? Have you ever had just a good talk with him? You know, one of the things I find is driving in my car can be a great place to have communion with God. You know, the other distractions are out. I don't do real well on my knees because I start, you know, my, you know, eyes get heavy and what have you. But, you know, driving, you kind of have God there in the passenger seat, and you're saying, hey, what about this and what about that? And help, you know, what about, how can we do this and what's going on here? You know, talk with God. Create that relationship with him. Spend that time with him. And so that's what I would encourage you today, is to first of all ask yourself, look at it. You know, the Apostle Paul says that the law itself is like a mirror. None of us ever grab the mirror and start trying to wash our face. Or do we take and, you know, start dealing with, you know, the smudge on the mirror? We're taking and saying, okay, what do I need to do here? Trust is also like a mirror. Ask yourself, am I trusting God? But then don't go to working on the trust. Say, okay, here's another area, God, where maybe I'm not trusting you as fully as I could, as fully as I should. Help me have the courage to get up each morning and come sit at your feet. Help me come get to know you. Bottom line, and no, it was just one of the things that God was telling me I needed to do for my own personal health, was I needed to change what my favorite beverage was in the morning. And, you know, that was a tough one. Because, you know, that had been my alarm clock. You know, there's this thing that kind of goes off and it starts brewing some just wonderful aromas. And it was like, wow. And then it was like, no, I'm not going to fight the fight of sin. I'm going to take a fight the fight of faith. And for I don't remember how many weeks it was, each morning I would get up and go into the kitchen, fill my cup, add the cream, add the sweetener, take my Bible and my Desire of Ages, and I go in and I say, God, you've got a problem. I don't know how to deal with this one. I'm through with the fighting. I'm tired. I can't do any more of this. Do it on my own. You've got a problem. Would you please solve it? And when you figure out how to get rid of it, I'm okay with you getting rid of it, but I'm not going to struggle. God is so wonderful. Diane goes into our doctor that does some biomeridian testings, and her test comes up really, really bad. In fact, he said the scores on it is what he would call a precancerous type body. And we'd had tests not that long before that had been really good. And it was like, wow, what's going on? He goes, you know, we've got to take and make some serious changes in your nutrition. We've got to put you on this very strict 3-week cleanse. And I had been on that before because that had actually shifted a lot with my health, and I knew what some of the ramifications were, and that meant you couldn't have your favorite beverage in the morning. And I didn't want to torment her by me having the coffee pot going first thing in the morning with her being on the cleanse. And so it was like, we've got to do whatever it takes to get her health back up. Well, you know, when you've got things that are of, you know, real serious import like that, you're going, hey, this could really be serious. We don't know what's going on. We've got to deal with it. It becomes very easy to give up things. You know, people give up their money very easily when someone points a gun at their head. They don't argue much. And so all of a sudden, you know, we're going through this cleanse and we're doing these things, and it wasn't stressful. It wasn't struggle. And all of a sudden, I'm in there in the morning having my devotions with God going, wow, God, I can't believe that lemon juice with sweetener and hot water could actually taste so good. Thank you, God, for doing it. And, you know, so God will do these things in and through you if you will take and keep coming into his presence, coming into his place, spending time with him. And so that is why, you know, for our closing song, we have the song, Sitting at the Feet of Jesus. This is the place where we need to be every day. And if you sit at his feet every day, everything else will take care of itself. He's promised it.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Wasatch Hills Church Podcast. For information about the Wasatch Hills Church, please visit us on the internet at www.wasatchhills.org. Or you may email Pastor Bernie Anderson at pastor@wasatchhills.org.